The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued.
Cassette 7, Side 1.
The grain crop was being taken into storage just then, and all the roads were full of lorries. They were due to finish work on October the 6th. 2 days earlier, on the 4th, two members of the group were transferred, Tenno and Volodya Krivoshein, the thief. They tried reporting sick in order to stay behind at any price, but the operations officer promised to transport them in handcuffs, whatever their condition. They decided that excessive resistance would arouse suspicion. They sacrificed themselves for their friends and submitted. So Tenno did not benefit from his insistence on joining the tunneling party. Instead of him, the 13th man would be his recruit and protégé, Zhdanok, who was by now far too unstable and erratic. It was a bad day for Stepan Konovalov and his friends when they gave in and told Tenno their secret. They finished digging and ended in the right place. Mutyanov had made no mistake, but there was snow on the ground, and they postponed their flight until it was drier. On October the 9th, they did everything precisely as planned. First four emerged successfully, Konovalov, Ryshkov, Mutyanov, and the Pole, who was his regular partner in escapes involving engineering. But the next to crawl into the trench was the hapless little Kolya Zhdanok. It was no fault of his, of course, that footsteps were suddenly heard up above and not far away, but he should have been patient, lain down, made himself inconspicuous, and crawled on when the footsteps had passed. Instead, in his usual smart aleck way, he stuck his head out. He had to see who was walking up there. The quickest louse is first on the knit comb, but as well as himself, this stupid louse destroyed an escape team equally remarkable for the cogency of their plan and for their ability to work smoothly together, ruined 14 long and difficult lives whose paths had intersected in this escape. In each of these lives, this attempt had a special importance. Without it, past and future were meaningless. On each of them, people somewhere still depended, women, children, and children still unborn. But a louse raised its head, and the whole thing went up in smoke. The passerby proved to be the deputy guard commander. He saw the louse, shouted, fired. And so the guards, although the plan had been far too clever for them and they had no inkling of it, became heroes. And my reader, the Marxist historian, tapping the page with his ruler, asks me in his patronizing drawl, "Yes, but why didn't you run away? Why didn't you revolt?" The escapers had levered back the grating, crawled into the hole, and nailed the skirting board to the trap, and now they had to crawl slowly, painfully back. Who has ever plumbed such depths of disillusionment and despair, seen such efforts so insultingly derided? They went back, switched off the lights in the tunnel, fitted the grating in its socket. Very soon the whole disciplinary barracks was swarming with camp officers, division officers, escort troops, jailers. All prisoners were checked against the records and driven into the stone jail. But they did not find the tunnel. How long would they have searched if everything had gone according to plan? Near the place where Zhdanok had broken cover, they found a half-filled-in hole. But even when they followed the tunnel under the barracks, they could not understand how the men had got down there or where they had put the earth. But the civilized section was four men short, and they gave the remaining eight a merciless going-over, the easiest way for boneheads to get at the truth. What point was there in further concealment? Later on, guided tours of the tunnel were arranged for the whole garrison and all the jailers. Major Maximenko, the big-bellied commandant of the Ekibastutz camp, used to boast to other area commandants at Gulag HQ, "You should see the tunnel at my place, like the metro. But we, our vigilance..." No, just one little louse. The hue and cry also prevented the first four out from reaching the railway crossing. The plan had collapsed. They climbed the fence of an empty worksite on the other side of the road, walked through it, climbed the fence again, and headed out onto the steppe. They decided against waiting in the settlement to pick up a lorry because it was already full of patrols. Like Tenno the year before, they quickly lost speed and faith. They set off southwest, toward Semipalatinsk. They had neither provisions nor strength for a long journey on foot. In the past day or two, they had strained themselves to the breaking point of finishing the tunnel. On the fifth day of their run, they looked in at a yurt and asked the Kazakhs for something to eat. They, needless to say, refused and shot at these hungry people with a hunting rifle. Is this tradition native to these shepherds of the steppe? And if not, where does it come from? Stepan Konovalov attacked a Kazakh, knife against gun, and took the gun and some provisions from him. They went on farther, but the Kazakhs tracked them down on horseback, came upon them near the Irtysh, and summoned an operations group. After that, they were surrounded, beaten to a bloody pulp, and after that, there's no need to continue. If anyone can show me any attempt to escape by 19th or 20th century Russian revolutionaries attended with such difficulties, such an absence of support from outside, such a hostile attitude on the part of the surrounding population, such lawless reprisals against the recaptured, let him do so. And after that, let him say, if he can, that we did not put up a fight. Chapter 9. The Kids with Tommy Guns. The camps were guarded by men in long greatcoats with black cuffs. They were guarded by Red Army men. They were guarded by prisoner guards. They were guarded by elderly reservists. Last came the robust youngsters born during the first five-year plan, who had seen no war service when they took their nice new Tommy guns and set about guarding us. Twice every day, for an hour at a time, we and they shuffled along, tied together in silent and deadly brotherhood. Any one of them was at liberty to kill any one of us. Every morning we dawdled listlessly along, we on the road and they on the shoulder, to a place where neither they nor we wished to go. Every evening we stepped out briskly, we to our pen, they to theirs. Since neither we nor they had any real home, these pens were home to us. We walked with never a glance at their sheepskin coats and their Tommy guns. What were they to us? They walked watching our dark ranks all the time. It was there in the regulations that they must watch us all the time. Orders were orders. Duty was duty. Any wrong movement, any false step, they must cut short with a bullet. How did they think of us in our dark jackets, our grey caps of Stalin fur, our grotesque felt boots that had served three sentences and shed four souls, our crazy quilt of number patches? Decent people would obviously never be treated like that. Was it surprising that our appearance inspired disgust? It was intended to do just that. From their narrow footpaths, the free inhabitants of the settlement, especially the schoolchildren and their women teachers, darted terrified glances at our columns as we were led down the broad street. They showed how much they dreaded that we, the devil's brood of fascism, might suddenly go berserk, overcome the convoy guards, and rush around looting, raping, burning, and killing. Obviously such bestial creatures could conceive no other desires. And inhabitants of the settlement were protected from these wild beasts by convoy troops, the noble convoy troops, a sergeant of convoy guards inviting the schoolteacher to dance in the club we had built for them, could feel like a knight in shining armor. These kids watched us the whole time, from the cordon and from the watchtowers, but they were not allowed to know anything about us. They were allowed only the right to shoot without warning. If they had just visited us in our huts of an evening, sat on our bunks and heard why this old man, or the other old fellow over there, was inside, those towers would have been unmanned and those Tommy guns would never have fired. But the whole cunning and strength of the system was in the fact that our deadly bond was forged from ignorance. Any sympathy they showed for us was punishable as treason, any wish to speak to us as a breach of a solemn oath. And what was the point of talking to us when the political instructor would come at fixed intervals to lead a discussion on the political and moral character of the enemies of the people whom they were guarding? He would explain in detail and with much repetition how dangerous these scarecrows were and what a burden to the state, which made it all the more tempting to try them out as living targets. He would bring some files under his arm and say that the special section had let him take a few cases just for the evening. He would read out some typewritten pages about evil doings for which all the ovens of Auschwitz would not be punishment enough, attributing them to the electrician who was mending the light on a post nearby, or to the carpenter from whom certain soldiers had imprudently thought of ordering lockers. The political instructor will never contradict himself, never make a slip. He will never tell the boys that some people are imprisoned here simply for believing in God, or simply for desiring truth, or simply for love of justice, or indeed for nothing at all. The whole strength of the system is in the fact that one man cannot speak directly to another, but only through an officer or a political instructor. The whole strength of these boys lies in their ignorance. The whole strength of the camps is in these boys, the boys with the red shoulder tabs, the murderers from watchtowers, the hunters of fugitives. Here is one such political lesson as remembered by a former convoy guard at Nyroblag. Lieutenant Samutin was a lanky, narrow-shouldered man, and his head was flat above the temples. He looked like a snake. He was tow-headed and almost without eyebrows. We knew that in the past he had shot people with his own hands. Now he was a political instructor, reciting in a monotonous voice, "The enemies of the people over whom you stand guard are the same as the fascists, filthy scum. We embody the power and the punitive sword of the motherland, and we must be firm. No sentimentality, no pity." That is how they mold the boys who make a point of kicking a runaway's head when he is down. The boys who can boot a piece of bread out of the mouth of a grey-haired old man in handcuffs. Who can look with indifference at a shackled runaway jounced on the splintery boards of a lorry. His face is blooded, his head is battered, but they look on unmoved. For they are the motherland's punitive sword, and he, so they say, is an American colonel. After Stalin's death, then living in eternal banishment, I was a patient in an ordinary free Tashkent clinic. Suddenly I heard a patient, a young Uzbek, telling his neighbours about his service in the army. His unit had, he said, kept guard on beasts and butchers. The Uzbek admitted that the convoy guards were also somewhat underfed, and it enraged them that prisoners, like miners, got rations, if of course they fulfilled the norm by 120%, not much smaller than those of honest soldiers. It also enraged them that they, the convoy guards, had to freeze on top of watchtowers in the winter, in sheepskin coats down to their heels, it's true, while the enemies of the people, once they entered the working area, scattered about the warming-up shacks, even from the watchtower he could have seen that it was not so, and slept there all day. He seriously imagined that the state's treatment of its enemies was philanthropic. Here was an interesting opportunity to look at a special camp through the eyes of a convoy guard. I began asking what kind of reptiles they were, and whether my Uzbek friend had talked to them personally. And of course he told me that he had learned all this from political officers, that they had even had cases read out to them in their political indoctrination sessions. And his malicious misconceptions about prisoners sleeping all day had of course been reinforced in him by the approving nods of officers. "Woe unto you that cause these little ones to stumble. Better for you had you never been born." The Uzbek also told us that a private in the MVD troops received 230 rubles a month, 12 times more than he would in the army. Why such generosity? Perhaps his service was 12 times more difficult. And in the polar regions, as much as 400 rubles for a fixed period of service, and with all expenses covered. He further told us of a number of incidents. Once, for instance, one of his comrades was marching in convoy and fancied that somebody was about to run out of the column. He pressed his trigger and killed 5 prisoners with a single burst. Since all the other guards later testified that the column had been moving quietly along, this soldier incurred a terrible punishment. For killing 5 people, he was put in detention for 15 days. In a warm guardhouse, of course. But which of the archipelago's inhabitants has no stories of this sort to tell? We knew so many of them in the corrective labor camps. On a work site which had no fence, but an invisible boundary line, a shot rang out, and a prisoner fell dead. He had stepped over the line, they said. He may have done nothing of the sort. The line was invisible, remember? But no one else would hurry over to check, for fear of lying beside him. Nor would a commission come to verify where the dead man's feet were lying. Perhaps, though, he had overstepped the line. After all, the guards could keep their eyes on it, whereas the prisoners had to work. The most conscientious prisoner, the prisoner with thoughts for nothing but his work, is the one most likely to be shot in this way. At Novochunka station, Otselag, haymaking, a prisoner sees a little more hay 2 or 3 steps away, and like a thrifty peasant decides to rake it in. A bullet, and the soldier gets a month's leave. Sometimes a particular guard is angry with a particular prisoner for refusing to do him a favour or failing to make something ordered, and avenges himself with a bullet. Sometimes it is done treacherously. The guard orders the prisoner to fetch something from beyond the boundary line. The prisoner goes off unsuspectingly, and the guard shoots. Or perhaps he tosses him a cigarette. Here, have a smoke. Even a cigarette will serve as bait for a prisoner, contemptible creature that he is. Why do they shoot? Sometimes there's no answer. In Kengir, for instance, in a tightly organized camp, in broad daylight when there was not the faintest possibility of an escape, a girl called Lida, a Western Ukrainian, contrived to wash her stockings in working hours and put them out to dry on the sloping ground of the camp fringe area. The man on the tower took aim and killed her outright. There was some vague rumor that he'd tried to commit suicide afterward. Why? Because the man has a gun. Because one man has the arbitrary power to kill or not to kill another. What's more, it pays. The bosses are always on your side. They'll never punish you for killing somebody. On the contrary, they'll commend you, reward you. And the quicker you are on the trigger, bring him down when he's only put half a foot wrong, the more vigilant you are seen to be, the higher your reward. A month's pay, a month's leave. Put yourself in the position of HQ. What sort of division is it that can point to no display of vigilance? What is wrong with its officers? Or perhaps the Zeks are so docile that the guard can be reduced. A security system once created needs deaths. Indeed, a sort of competition springs up between sharpshooters. You killed somebody and bought butter with your prize money, so I'll kill somebody and buy butter too. Want to pop home and paw your girl a bit? Just plug that grey thing over there, and away you go for a month. These were all cases of a kind familiar to us in the corrective labour camps, but in the special camps there were novelties. Shooting straight into a marching column, for instance, as the Uzbek's comrade did. Or as they did at the guardhouse in Otselag on September the 8th, 1952. Or shooting from the towers into the camp area. It meant that they'd been trained to it. This was the work of the political officers. In Kengir in May 1953, these kids with Tommy guns suddenly, and without provocation, opened fire on a column which had halted outside the camp and was waiting to be searched on entry. 16 were wounded, but these were no ordinary wounds. The guards were using dum-dum bullets, which capitalists and socialists had long ago joined in banning. The bullets left craters in their bodies, tore holes in their entrails and their jaws, mangled their extremities. Now why should convoy guards at a special camp be armed with dum-dum bullets? On whose authority? We shall never know. All the same, they were very hurt when they read in my story that prisoners called their escort troops screws, saw the word repeated for all the world to hear. No, no, the prisoners should have loved them and called them guardian angels. One of these youngsters, one of the better ones, it's true, who didn't take offence but wants to defend the truth as he sees it, is Vladilian Zadorny, born 1933, served in the MVD troops, infantry guard unit, at Niroblag from the age of 18 to the age of 20. He has written me several letters. Boys did not join of their own wish. They were called up by the Commissariat of War. The Commissariat passed them on to the Ministry of Internal Affairs. The boys were taught to shoot and stand guard. The boys cried with the cold at night. What the hell did they want with places like Niroblag and all that they contained? You mustn't blame the lads. They were soldiers serving their motherland. And although there were things they didn't understand about this absurd and dreadful form of service, how much then did they understand? It's either all or nothing, A.S. They had taken their oath. Their service was not easy. That is frank and honest. There is something to think about here. These lads were shut up inside a picket fence of words. Remember your oath, serving your motherland, your soldiers now. Yes, but their underlying common humanity must have been weak or altogether lacking if it was not proof against an oath and a few political discussion periods. Not every generation and not every people is of the stuff from which such boys are fashioned. This is surely the main problem of the 20th century. Is it permissible merely to carry out orders and commit one's conscience to someone else's keeping? Can a man do without ideas of his own about good and evil, and merely derive them from the printed instructions and verbal orders of his superiors? Oaths, these solemn pledges pronounced with a tremor in the voice, and intended to defend the people against evildoers. See how easily they can be misdirected to the service of evildoers and against the people. Let us remember what Vasily Vlasov meant to say to his executioner back in 1937. It is your fault. You alone are to blame that they kill people. My death is on your head alone, and you must live with that. If there were no executioners, there would be no executions. If there were no convoy troops, there would be no camps. Of course, neither our contemporaries nor history will ignore the hierarchy of guilt. Of course, it is obvious to all that their officers were more guilty. The security officers more guilty still. Those who drew up the orders and instructions even more guilty, and those who ordered them to be drawn up most guilty of all. This does not mean that they would be brought to trial. Someone should ascertain whether they are satisfied with their pensions and dachas. But shots were fired. Camps were guarded. Tommy guns were held at the ready, not by them, but by those boys. Men were kicked about the head as they lay on the ground, by no one else, by those boys. Vladilen writes also, "They dinned into us. They forced us to learn by heart, USO 43SS, the 1943 regulations of the Infantry Prison Guard, top secret, a cruel and frightening document." I wonder, by the way, whether we are fully aware of the part which this sinister double sibilant plays in our lives, in one abbreviation after another, beginning with KPSS, CPSU, Communist Party of the Soviet Union, translation, and KPSS-OVTSI, party members. Here we find that the regulations, too, were SS, Sotosheno Sekretny, top secret, translation, as is everything excessively secret. Obviously, those who drafted these regulations were conscious of their foulness, but drafted them nonetheless. And at what a time! We had just driven the Germans back from Stalingrad. One more fruit of the people's victory. Then there was the oath. Then we had to heed the security officers and political officers. There was slander and denunciations. Cases were trumped up against some of the soldiers themselves. Divided as they were by the stockade and the barbed wire, the men in the overall jackets and the men in greatcoats were equally prisoners, the former for 25 years, the latter for 3. It is putting it rather strongly to say that the infantrymen were also imprisoned, only not by a military tribunal, but by the commissariat of war. Equally prisoners they were not, because the people in greatcoats could freely cut down with their tommy guns people in work jackets, mow down a crowd of them, indeed, as we shall soon see. Vladilen further explains that the lads were of all sorts. There were blinkered old sweats who hated Zeks. Incidentally, the new recruits from some ethnic minorities, Bashkir, Buryat, Yakut, were very keen. Then there were those who just didn't care, the majority. They performed their service quietly and uncomplainingly. What they liked best was the tear-off calendar and post-time. Finally, there were decent chaps who felt sorry for the Zeks as victims of misfortune. And most of us realized that our service was unpopular with the people. When we went on leave, we did not wear uniforms. Vladilen's own life story is his best argument in support of his ideas, though we must remember that there were very few like him. He was allowed into the convoy guard service by an oversight on the part of a lazy special section. His stepfather, the old trade union official Voinino, had been arrested in 1937, and his mother expelled from the party as a result. His father, who had commanded a Cheka squad and had been a party member since 1917, made haste to disown both his former wife and his son, and so he kept his party card, but he was nevertheless demoted. Although we have long ago learned to expect anything, there are still a few surprises left. Because his abandoned wife's second husband is arrested, must a man disown his 4-year-old son? And not just any man, but a squad commander in the Cheka? His mother tried to wash away her stain as a blood donor during the war. It was all right. Party members and non-party members alike took her blood. The boy had hated the Blue Caps from childhood, and now they put one on my own head. The terrible night when people in my father's uniform roughly searched my cot had left too deep a mark in my young memory. I was not a good convoy guard. I used to get into conversation with the Zeks and do them favors. I would leave my rifle by the campfire while I went to buy things for them at the stall or post their letters. I dare say that there were people at the Intermediate, Misakot, and Parma separate campsites who still remembered Private Volodya. A prisoner foreman told me, "If you look at people and hear their troubles, you will understand." I saw my grandfather, my uncle, my aunt in every one of the political prisoners. I simply hated my officers. I grumbled and complained and told the other soldiers, "There are the real enemies of the people." For this, for open insubordination, sabotage, and for consorting with the Zek, I was sent for interrogation. Lanky Sumotin whipped me across the face, rapped my knuckles with a paperweight, because I would not give him a signed confession that I had posted letters for Zeks. I would have squelched that tapeworm. I'm a silver medalist at boxing. I could cross myself with an 80-pound weight, but there were two warders hanging on to me. Still, the interrogators had other things on their minds. The MVD in 1953 didn't know whether it was coming or going. They didn't put me inside. They just gave me a dishonorable discharge under Article 47G, discharged from the organs of the MVD for extreme insubordination and gross breaches of MVD regulations. Then they threw me out of the divisional guardhouse, beaten up and frozen, to make my way home. Arsene, a foreman, released at this time, looked after me on the way. Let us imagine that a convoy guard officer wanted to show the prisoners some leniency. He could, of course, only do it through his soldiers and in their presence, which means that, given the general savagery, it would be embarrassing and, in fact, impossible. Besides, someone would immediately inform on him. That's the system for you. Chapter 10. Behind the wire, the ground is burning. No, the surprising thing is not that mutinies and risings did not occur in the camps, but that in spite of everything, they did. Like all embarrassing events in our history, which means three-quarters of what really happened, these mutinies have been neatly cut out and the gap hidden with an invisible join. Those who took part in them have been destroyed, and even remote witnesses frightened into silence. The reports of those who suppressed them have been burned or hidden in safes within safes within safes, so that the risings have already become a myth, although some of them happened only 15 and others only 10 years ago. No wonder some say that there was no Christ, no Buddha, no Muhammad. There you're dealing in thousands of years. When it can no longer disturb any living person, historians will be given access to what is left of the documents. Archaeologists will do a little digging, heat something in a laboratory, and the dates, locations, contours of these risings, with the names of their leaders, will come to light. We shall see the first outbreaks, like the Red Union affair of January 1942, in the Oshkuria separate campsite near Ust-Ussi. Red Union is said to have been a free employee, perhaps even in charge of this detachment. He sounded the call to the 58s and the socially harmful, Article 7, Section 35, and rallied a few hundred volunteers. They disarmed the convoy, which consisted of short-sentence prisoner guards, and escaped with some horses into the forest to live as partisans. They were killed off gradually. In spring 1945, people who had no connection with it at all were still being jailed for the Red Union affair. Perhaps we, no, not we ourselves, shall learn at the same time about the legendary rising in 1948 at Public Works Site number 501, where the Sivaya-Muska-Salakhard Railway was under construction. It was legendary because everybody in the camps talked about it in whispers, but no one really knew anything. Legendary also because it broke out not in the special camp system, where the mood and the grounds for it by now existed, but in a corrective labour camp, where people were isolated from each other by fear of informers and trampled underfoot by thieves, where even their right to be politicals was spat upon, and where a prison mutiny therefore seemed inconceivable. According to the rumours, it was all the work of ex-soldiers, recent ex-soldiers. It could not have been otherwise. Without them, the 58th lacked stamina, spirit, and leadership. But these young men, hardly any of them over 30, were officers and enlisted men from our fighting armies, or their fellows who had been prisoners of war. Among these, some had been with Vlasov or Krasnov, or in the nationalist units. There were men who had fought against each other, but here, oppression united them. These young men who had served on all fronts in a world war, who were expert in modern infantry warfare, camouflage, and picking off patrols, these young men, except those who were scattered singly, still retained in 1948 their wartime élan and belief in themselves, and they could not accept the idea that men like themselves, whole battalions of them, should meekly die. Even escape seemed to them a contemptible half-measure, rather like deserting one by one instead of facing the enemy together. It was all planned and begun in one particular team, an ex-colonel called Voronin or Voronov, a one-eyed man, is said to have been the leader. A first lieutenant of armoured troops, Sakurenko, is also mentioned. The team killed their convoy guards. In those days, convoy guards, often unlike their charges, were not real soldiers, but reservists. Then they went and freed a second team and a third. They attacked the convoy guards' hamlet, then the camp from outside, removed the sentries from the towers, and opened up the camp area. The inevitable schism now took place. Though the gates were wide open, most of the Zeks would not go through them. These included prisoners with short sentences who had nothing to gain from mutiny. There were others with tenors, or even with 15 years under the 7/8 and 4/6 decrees, who would be worse off under Article 58. Finally, there were even 58s of the sort who preferred to die kneeling loyally rather than on their feet. Nor were all those who poured out through the gate necessarily on their way to help the mutineers. Some felons happily broke bounds to plunder the free settlements. Arming themselves with weapons taken from the guards, who were later buried at the Kochmas cemetery, the rebels went on to capture the neighbouring camp division. With their combined forces, they decided to advance on Vorkuta. It was only 60 kilometres away. But this was not to be. Parachute troops were dropped to bar their way. Then low-flying fighter planes raked them with machine gun fire and dispersed them. They were tried, more of them were shot, and others given 25 or 10 years. At the same time, many of those who had not joined in the operation but remained in the camp had their sentences refreshed. The hopelessness of this rising as a military operation is obvious, but would you say that dying quietly by inches was more hopeful? The special camps were set up soon after this, and most of the 58s were raked out. What was the result? In 1949, in the Nizhny Aturyakh division of Berlag, a mutiny started in much the same way. They disarmed their guards, took 6 or 8 Tommy guns, attacked the camp from outside, knocked the sentries off the towers, cut the telephone wires, and opened up the camp. This time there was no one in the camp who was not numbered, branded, doomed, beyond all hope. And what do you think happened? Most prisoners would not pass through the gates. Those who had started it all and now had nothing to lose turned the mutiny into a breakout, and a group of them headed for Milgi. At Elgino Toscana, their way was barred by troops and light tanks. General Semyonov was in command of the operation. They were all killed. I do not claim that my account of these risings is entirely accurate. I shall be grateful to anyone who can correct me. Riddle. What is the quickest thing in the world? Answer, thought. It is, and it isn't. It can be slow, too. Oh, how slow. Only slowly and laboriously do men, people, society, realize what has happened to them, realize the truth about their position. In herding the 58th into special camps, Stalin was exerting his strength mainly for his own amusement. He already had them as securely confined as they could be, but he thought he would be craftier than ever and improve on his best. He thought he knew how to make it still more frightening. The results were quite the opposite. The whole system of oppression elaborated in his reign was based on keeping malcontents apart, preventing them from reading each other's eyes and discovering how many of them there were, instilling it into all of them, even into the most dissatisfied, that no one was dissatisfied except for a few doomed individuals, blindly vicious and spiritually bankrupt. In the special camps, however, there were malcontents by the thousand. They knew their numerical strength, and they realized that they were not spiritual paupers, that they had a nobler conception of what life should be than their jailers, than their betrayers, than the theorists who tried to explain why they must rot in camps. This novel aspect of the special camp went almost unnoticed at first. On the face of it, things went on as though it was a continuation of the corrective labor camp. Except that the thieves, those pillars of camp discipline and of authority, soon lost heart. Still, crueler warders and an enlarged disciplinary barracks seemed to compensate for this loss. But mark this, when the thieves lost heart, there was no more pilfering in the camp. You could now leave your rations in your locker. You could drop your shoes on the floor for the night instead of putting them under your pillow, and they would be there in the morning. You could leave your pouch on your locker for the night instead of lying with it in your pocket and rubbing the tobacco to dust. Trivialities, you say? No, all enormously important. Once there was no pilfering, people began to look at their neighbours kindly and without suspicion. Listen, lads, maybe we really are politicals. And if we're politicals, we can speak a bit more freely. Between two bunks or by the fire on the work site. Better look around, of course, in case somebody's listening. Come to think of it, it doesn't matter a damn if they frame us. If you've got a quarter already, what else can they do to you? The old camp mentality. You die first, I'll wait a bit. There is no justice, so forget it. That's the way it was, and that's the way it will be. Also began to disappear. Why forget it? Why must it always be so? Teammates begin quietly talking to each other, not about rations, not about gruel, but about things which you never hear mentioned outside, and talking more and more freely all the time, until the foreman's fist suddenly ceases to throb with self-importance. Some foremen stop raising their fists altogether, others use them less often and less heavily. The foreman himself, instead of towering over his men, sits down to listen and to chat, and his team begin to look on him as a comrade. After all, he's one of us. The foremen come to the production planning section or the accounts office, and from discussing with them dozens of small questions, whose rations should be cut and whose shouldn't, whom to assign to which job, the trustees too are affected by this breath of fresh air, this small cloud of seriousness, responsibility, and purpose. Not all of them at once. They had come to these camps greedily intent on grabbing the best jobs, and they had succeeded. They saw no reason why they shouldn't live as well as in the corrective labor camps, shutting themselves up in their private rooms, roasting their potatoes with pork fat, live their own lives separately from the workers. But no, it turned out that there was something more important than all this. And what might that be? It became indecent to boast of being a bloodsucker, as people did in the corrective labor camps, to boast that you lived at the expense of others. So trustees would make friends among the workers, spread their nice new jerkins beside the workers' grubby ones, and lie on the ground happily chatting their Sundays away. People could no longer be divided into such crude categories as in the corrective labor camps, trustees and workers, non-politicals and 58s. The breakdown was much more complex and interesting. People from the same region, religious groups, men of practical experience, men of learning. It would take the authorities a long, long time to notice or understand, but the worker signers no longer carried clubs and didn't even bellow as loudly as before. They addressed the foremen in a friendly way. For example, "Must be about time to get your men out to work, Komov." Not because they were overcome by remorse, but because there was something new and disquieting in the air. But all this happened slowly. These changes took months and months and months. They did not affect every foreman and every trustee, only those in whom some remnants of conscience and fraternal feeling still glowed under the ashes. Those who preferred to go on being bastards found no difficulty in doing just that. As yet there was no real shift of consciousness, no heroic shift, no spiritual upheaval. The camp remained a camp as before. We were as much oppressed and as helpless as ever. There was still no hope for us but to crawl away under the wire and run out into the steppe, to be showered with bullets and hunted down with dogs. A bold thought, a desperate thought, a thought to raise a man up. How could things be changed so that instead of us running from them, they would run from us? Once the question was put, once a certain number of people had thought of it and put it into words, and a certain number had listened to them, the age of escapes was over. The age of rebellion had begun. But how to begin? Where to begin? We were shackled. We were wrapped about by tentacles. We were deprived of freedom of movement. Where could we begin? Far from simple in this life are the simplest things of all. Even in the corrective labour camps, some people seem to have got around to the idea that stool pigeons should be killed. Even there, accidents were sometimes arranged. A log would roll off a pile and knock a stoolie into the swollen river. So that it shouldn't have been difficult to figure out in the special camps which tentacles to hack off first. You would expect everybody to see that, yet nobody did. Suddenly, a suicide. In the disciplinary barracks, hut number 2, a man was found hanging. I am going through the stages of the process as they occurred in Ekibastutz, but note that the stages were just the same in other special camps. The bosses were not greatly upset. They cut him down and wheeled him off to the scrap heap. A rumour went around the work team. The man was an informer. He hadn't hanged himself. He had been hanged, as a lesson to the rest. There were a lot of filthy swine in the camp, but none so hoggish, so crude, so brazen as Timofey S. Blank, who was in charge of the mess hut. I'm not concealing his surname, I just don't remember it. His bodyguards were the fat, pig-faced cooks, and he had also hand-reared a retinue of thuggish orderlies. He and his retainers beat the Zeks with fists and sticks. On one occasion, quite unjustly, he struck a short, swarthy prisoner, whom everybody called the Kid. It was not his habit to notice whom he was beating, but there were no mere kids, as things now were in the special camps, and this Kid was also a Muslim. There were quite a few Muslims in the camp. They were not just common criminals. You could see them praying at sunset at the western end of the camp area. In a corrective labour camp, people would have laughed, but we did not, throwing up their arms and pressing their foreheads to the ground. They had elders, and true to the spirit of the times, they met in council. The motion was to avenge themselves. Early one Sunday morning, the victim, together with an adult companion, an Ingush, slipped into the trustee's hut while they were still wallowing in bed, and each of them quickly stuck a knife into the fat hog. But how green we still were. They did not try to hide their faces or to run away. At peace with themselves, now that duty was done, they went with their bloody knives straight from the corpse to the warder's room and gave themselves up. They would be put on trial. All these were tentative fumblings. All this could perhaps have happened in a corrective labour camp, but civic thought made further strides. Perhaps this was the crucial link at which the chain must be broken. Kill the stoolie. That was it, the vital link. A knife in the heart of the stoolie. Make knives and cut stoolies' throats. That was it. Now, as I write this chapter, rows of humane books frown down at me from the walls, the tarnished gilt on their well-worn spines glinting reproachfully like stars through cloud. Nothing in the world should be sought through violence. By taking up the sword, the knife, the rifle, we quickly put ourselves on the level of our tormentors and persecutors, and there will be no end to it. There will be no end. Here, at my desk, in a warm place, I agree completely. If you ever get 25 years for nothing, if you find yourself wearing 4 number patches on your clothes, holding your hands permanently behind your back, submitting to searches morning and evening, working until you are utterly exhausted, dragged into the cooler whenever someone denounces you, trodden deeper and deeper into the ground, from the hole you're in, the fine words of the great humanists will sound like the chatter of the well-fed and free. There will be no end of it, but will there be a beginning? Will there be a ray of hope in our lives or not? The oppressed, at least, concluded that evil cannot be cast out by good. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.